Hey, Wayne.
Hi, Steve.
What is this? I'm ready to go the right way this
anybody
time.
Anybody there? No, I'm here.
I'm ready to do this intro the right way.
Okay,
because
good.
Because the last episode, episode 3, I struggled a little bit. It was like it was my first episode. So, you struggled a little bit too. You have at times this
here
year.
Here we go, I'm ready.
So this is season 2, episode 4 of
Randolay Theater!
The podcast. Woo. Should we just roll into the interview now? That was pretty good.
Roll the tape.
today's interview really is what this entire season has been building up to in one regard, is the 50th anniversary of 1969.
Very cool. 1969, the Miracle Mets, as Howie says, the greatest New York sports story of them all.
Probably is.
Yeah?
I mean, it probably is.
It's in the perspective of then. That team was a baby still. They was just learning how to walk. They were in last place.
And they were falling over a lot
year.
Learning
yeah,
how to
they,
walk.
They lost all the time, every season. They had never even been above 500, late in a season or ever, maybe, until at some point in the early part of 1969.
No,
certainly
it, yeah.
Had never been in first place. Yeah. So this was a team that was reaching its heights for the first time and doing so in a way that I don't think anyone really expected.
Yeah, it's an incredible. You know, I think part of the problem sometimes now is it's 50 years later, and so you don't have a ton of people that are sitting there with vivid memories talking about what happened in 1969. But I think that's one of the cool things that we've experienced all season is, from our perspective, getting to talk to all of these guys again. And today we spoke with Cleon Jones. Well, today's episode is with Cleon Jones. Mm-hmm. But we've talked to all these guys, right? We talked, I mean, obviously Crane Pool's been around a lot, and there's, great news with him and his kidney, but so many of them have been around during spring training, have been around during the season, and you live it through them again, and you take a step back and realize how remarkable it really was.
Yeah, especially for these guys to be together again. When this episode comes out, it'll be just 2 days before the reunion weekend at Citi Field, and I know all these guys are excited. Jerry Kuzman's going to be at Citi Field, and I know they wish that Tom Seaver would be back in New York to be a part of this, but he's going to be highly honored here in the next couple of days. So it's a great thing for these guys to look back and to talk to Cleon Jones. You know, he's the man who caught the final out. He was the number 3 hitter on this team, and he was a big part of the reason why they won.
He was. We spoke to him back in spring training. He was the first episode of this season that we recorded, and let's just say it lived up to the hype. This is a guy that does not lack in energy and in storytelling, and he really, I mean, we had a ball. We probably could have gone a couple of hours with him. Not sure if you guys would stick around.
I think they would. That's how great Cleon was. And I think we're ready to let everybody hear it.
So
I hope everybody enjoys it.
What should we do? I'm going to let you do
it. We should roll the tape.
Well, Cleon, this is a real treat for us. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. And if you're listening to this, if you're not watching this podcast, you're sitting here in full uniform right now. So what's it like after all this time to get back into the full Mets uniform?
Well, I'm in full uniform, and long as I'm sitting down here, I feel like I'm 17, 18 years of age. But once I stand up, I'm again 75.
This is 50 years since 1969. Does it feel like it's been that long? Can you believe it?
No, I keep saying the same thing over and over again. Time flies, and Mickey Mantle said years ago, had I known I was going to live as long as this, I would have taken better care of myself. But it doesn't seem, it seems like yesterday, because when I wake up in the morning, when I open my eyes, I can see myself catching the last out. And memories like that, they're always fresh. You know, they never get stale. And you'll never fall away from those memories, because it was the highlight of your life. Winning the World Series, the highlight of my life, you know, well, it wasn't one or two. My kids and my wife had to be not one and two, but it was right up there with that. And having the pleasure of making the last catch or the last out, and I'm going to say the last catch, because there were two great catches in that ball game, Svoboda and A.G. A.G., I've seen him make those catches before. Svoboda, That was the first time. Yeah.
I was gonna say, how shocked were you out there?
Well, he actually, when I saw him try to make that catch 1,000 times, but it never came up with it. When I was in center field and he was in right field, I ended up running to the wall to retrieve the ball. But he finally made that catch on the biggest stage in baseball, the World Series. And he made it so gracefully that he had the presence of mind to roll over, jump up, and throw a strike to home plate. But even with all of that, I said to the both of them, my catch was the greatest of all. My catch ended the game.
Yeah.
And Yogi said it best, it's not over until it's over.
That's right.
And it was over when you caught that ball.
It was over.
What did it feel like you guys were underdogs? You were with the Mets for a while before 1969. You were there for a lot of the losing years. So did it feel to you like this was an underdog story, that you guys were David against Goliath when it came to the Orioles?
Well, it was an underdog year. And when you finish last, and now you're first as relate to winning the championship in the National League and beating a good team with the Braves, probably had five or six best hitters in baseball on that team, and we were able to beat them. We beat the Braves, but we didn't beat Hank Aaron. Mm-hmm. Hank got his hits. And he had a good series, but we were able to beat the Braves. But we never felt like underdogs, because by the end of August, we thought we were the best team in baseball. Mm-hmm. That's the way we talk, that's the way we act, and that's the way we presented ourselves as a team. And it was all because of Gale Hodges. He instilled that winning attitude in all of us. And I tell everybody, anywhere, that he would have been a Hall of Fame manager had he lived. Having said that, if not for Gale Hodges, we wouldn't be talking about the 1969 Mets. Because he prepared us from day one. Spring training, the first day in spring training, he said to this group, you are a lot better than what you think you are. And it would be proven throughout the season. And sure enough, we proved it, especially after July.
Did you guys believe him when he said that initially?
Hell no. We all looked around at each other and said, what in the hell is he talking about? He was here last year. We finished last.
Was there a moment that stood out that proved it, that proved that he was right?
Yeah.
Before you caught that ball in game five of the World Series?
Before it was all over, yeah. that were times when we knew we could match up any pitching staff in the league. We knew that in June. But we wasn't the best hitting team in June, because we were kind of weak against left-handers. But when we got Clint Denham, that changed everything. So we was already a team with great pitching arms, not great pitchers at the time. Siebel was a great pitcher at that time. Kuzma was right there. But we didn't know what Gentry would do. We thought Nolan would be fantastic. He had a Hall of Fame arm. And McGraw, potentially, we could match up with anybody on the mound. But the Cubs had a better lineup, the Cardinals, Pittsburgh, you can go on and on and on. But Gale Hodges had a plan. We're going to scratch for runs, but we're not going to give up many runs. We're not going to beat ourselves defensively. We're going to make other folks beat us. And he preached that all the time. If you don't beat yourself, it's hard for the other team to beat you. And that was proven. We won a lot of one-run ball games. We was in every ball game, practically, until the ninth inning, and we had a chance to win. So by August, there were no contests. We felt like we were it. We were the real shit.
You know, you personally had your best season ever that year. Hit 340 that season, an all-star. What, for you, was the difference that year? What allowed you to get to that level in 69?
Well, I tell you what really happened to me. In 68, I had a chance to hit 300 on the last day. I went 2 for 5, and I ended up hitting 298. Hmm. And that's because in 68, I got off to a bad start. And I said to myself that I'm going to work hard to get off to a good start. If I get to a good start, I know I can hit 300. And that's what I concentrated on it throughout spring training. And I was able to get off to a pretty good start. No doubt in my mind, I would have won a batting championship had I not cracked 2 ribs. And because when that happened, I wasn't just maintaining. I was around 350, but I was going up. Because I was having it my way. And when a hitter can go to the plate and he's almost confident that he's going to have a good at bat. And that's the way I felt. I felt it didn't matter who was pitching. Koufax, Gibson, I didn't care who was pitching, because I knew I was going to have good at bats. And when you concentrate on good at bats, especially 4 good at bats, you're going to come up with hits. And but when I cracked those ribs, I was out for 3 weeks. I couldn't run, I couldn't throw, I couldn't do anything. All I could do was come to the ballpark and get treatment. And when I got back in the lineup, it took me a while to find it. I couldn't find it. As a matter of fact, I didn't find it, and I wasn't smart enough to go to the films. I was the only one at that time looking at film.
Is that true?
There was nobody on my ball club even thinking about looking at film. I was looking at film. See, we were filming pitches because we had all them great arms, but what I would do, I would get Joe to film me. So when I got into a rut, I could go back to the film and see what I was doing differently. But I didn't think about studying the films until it was season that just about ended. Because that was a situation where I got pitches that I missed that should have been line drive somewhere. And I just got under, or I just fouled it off. And a month before that, I wasn't missing those pitches. So the hardest person to conquer in this game is yourself. Mm-hmm. See, the guy on the mound doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what he throws, where he throws it. If you're on your game, you're gonna have good at bats. And I learned that in 68, and it carried over to 69, which allowed me to have a good start. And I probably would have won the batting championship, and probably would have won it couple of times after that. But when we lost Gil Hodges, we lost a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You talked about having a tough time to start 1968. Tommy Agee had a bad year in 1968. It was his first year with the Mets, and then he came back in 1969 and had a great season like you did. You know, a lot of people know that you and Tommy are both from Mobile. They may not know that you went to high school together. You played high school baseball and high school football together. What did it mean to you two guys to end up on the same major league team and eventually winning together?
Yeah. Well, in 68, when Tommy came over, I said to him, I said, spring training. I said, give some pitching today. I said, he's going to find out who you are. He said, what you mean? I said, he's going to throw at you and find out whether you can take it. He's going to find out if you can beat him or not. He said, man, this spring training. I said, I'm telling you what's going to happen. I said, all you got to do is, you know, make sure you duck the first pitch and maybe the second pitch, and then have a good at bat. He won't throw at you. I ain't thinking about Gibson. I faced guys. I said, no, you haven't faced anybody like this. I said, there's nobody in the American League like that, like Gibson. So, first time up, bam! Gibson hit him in the head. He falls out. I run out there, doctor asking how many and all of that.
You got it right? Nope.
He said, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I said, what the hell happened? I said, Excedrin headache number 45. Gibson number was 45.
Yeah.
So he, you know, they took him to get x-rays and he was in the hospital. I went by to see him. In the newspaper in St. Pete, that's what it read the next day. Gibson, AG, Excedrin headache number 45. Bold print. All right, I show it to him. And he cussed me out. You fuck! From that day forward, he never got a hit off Gibson.
Is that right?
Never wanted to hit off Gibson. If we went in St. Louis and Gibson was pitching the first day, he was happy about that. He wanted to just get Gibson out of the way. 0 for 4, okay, go ahead. But after that, Carlton and everybody else that come behind, he had good at bats. But I said all that to say that in 68, that's the year I realized that I could be a 300 hitter. And we went home that year, Mobile, Hank, Billy, Tommy Aaron, Boland. We all worked out together.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew Tommy when we played in high school together. You know, I knew his swing. I knew what he did to get ready. And we worked on that. And when we came to spring training the next year, he was a different player. He had more confidence. He still didn't want to see Gibson, but but he had more confidence in his ability because he was a great outfielder. And he played Shea center field better than anybody that ever played, even Willie and Kirk Flood and all the good mm-hmm. outfielders that played there. He played better than any of them. And so we knew we had the best defensive catcher in baseball. Johnny Bench, you know, I'm not slighting him. He's the best catcher in baseball, offensively and defensively. But Grody was number one defensively. And Buddy was great at shortstop. And then now you got Tommy in the outfield. He's great in center field. See, he was so good in center field, he helped out in left and right. So didn't put much pressure on me or Shamsky or Svoboda, you know, because he covered a lot of ground. So what most people don't realize is that we had a platoon system. And we were being platooned and we didn't even know it.
Yeah. Most of the team, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
the only four guys that knew they was going to be in the lineup were Grody, Harrison, AG, and myself.
Mm.
Everybody else platooned. And we won, and we were a good team with a platoon system. And oftentimes, Gil would let right-hander hit against right-handers, because if he need them in certain situation, mm-hmm. you know, they would yeah. see it. They'd be able to see that. And he was preparing us to be a good team. We never even realized it.
Why do you think that system worked so well for you guys, considering what you just said, where you didn't even know what platooning was at that point in time? Why were so many guys okay with splitting their time the way that team
yeah,
was?
Yeah, but they weren't okay. They weren't satisfied. They wanted to play every day. Clendenin wanted to play every day. Cranepool wanted to play every day. All the guys wanted to play every day. But Gil Hodges was in control. And he had a 25-man roster that he wanted to use and to be at his disposal. Come, you know, whatever the situation was, you're going to fit in somewhere. And you got to be prepared. If you're going to pinch hit, when he called you to pinch hit, you better be ready to go up there to pinch hit. Because in the next day, if you need a pinch hitter, you're not going to be used. So you at least got to go up and represent yourself and give a good at bat. So he prepared us both mentally and physically to play every day, even though we weren't guys weren't playing every day. Shamsie was a good enough hitter to play against left-handers and right-handers. So was Crane Pool. But Clendenin made us a better ball club against left-handers because he protected me. And for me to get protection, a guy that's hitting 340, 350 at that time, people didn't have to nibble at me. They had to come right at me. So that allowed me a chance to get the pitches that I could drive, and he could drive us in. So but just like I said before, organizations win championship. See, the Mets, when I got AG, 68, they got Al Weiss, they got a few other guys. Now, complete the puzzle, they went and got Clendenin the next year. They knew what they needed. So Johnny Murphy and Gail Hodges went out and got them, and got those players. Oftentimes, the pieces of the puzzle might not come from your farm team because they're not ready. Mm-hmm. But they went out and got these three players, and they all made a difference, especially in the World Series. Mm-hmm. Look what Al Weiss did. He hit two home runs. Nobody expected Al to hit. But he was a good player. But he wasn't the kind of player that you wanted to play every day. All right. He was a good fielder, but he wasn't a Buddy Harrison. Mm-hmm. Nobody was as good as Buddy offensively during that time. I mean defensively in the league. Right. He could make all the plays and make all the throws.
And we hear about maximizing roster space now. We hear about depth and using all your players. We hear that a lot with the Mets now. Mm-hmm. Gil Hodges even used four outfielders for the big sluggers in the league, something that seems very advanced for that time. Yeah. Why do you think Gil has not been put in the Hall of Fame yet, whether it's as a player or as a manager? And why does it seem like he hasn't gotten a lot of the credit that maybe he deserves?
Well, He was a, first of all, he was a great ball player. Every first baseman wanted to be like Gil Hodges, all right? I think in 1955, well, he went 0 for forever in the World Series. Uh-huh. And everybody looked down on him, but he was good all year. And had he hit 300 and went 10 for 22, he'll probably be in the Hall of Fame. Name me one first baseman better than Gil Hodges. It's hard to reach out. You know, you can go McCovey or maybe, but all around, even McCovey wasn't better. He was a good defensive player. He was a good offensive player. But Gil Hodges was the innovator. And I say that because he put me in some situations I really didn't like, but it was challenging. He used to bring me in from the outfield when that was a bunt situation with a pitcher. Bring me in between first base and the pitcher's mound to make the plays. And I blame that on myself because I used to like to get in the infield and let the coaches hit ground balls to me, both on first base, second base, and they thought I had pretty good hands.
Yeah.
And I was sorry many times that I did that.
If they wouldn't have known, you wouldn't have known.
But he brought me in occasionally. And occasionally, I'd be between the pitcher's mound and first base, and a pitcher would take a big swing.
Yeah.
You know, well, but he could have lucked up and made contact. And that have made me fall out with Gil Hodges. But luckily, that didn't happen. And I got lucky to make a couple plays in doing so. And Gil was one of my favorite people because he was a manager that covered all the bases. You know, he didn't close the barn door when the horse was out and gone. he was always two or three steps ahead of the game. And we went out to the mound to get a pitch out. You couldn't talk him out of it. He had made his mind up when he went to the mound.
Yeah. And I know you said there was a misunderstanding, too, publicly about what happened that one time he took you out of the game in 69.
When he walked out on the field and it got me, because we had a conversation in Montreal. And like I said, I was swinging the bat so good, I didn't want to come out of the lineup because I was really contributing to the team. And what I said to him is, as long as I'm not hurting the team, well, I can't move at all. I want to stay in the lineup. So he said, okay, I can go along with that. So this particular, we were playing Houston. Mm-hmm. And they were kicking our tails, man. they were putting a old country whooping on us. And it had rained pretty much the day before. The field was wet. And I'm in left field, and Johnny Edwards, he's a left-handed hitter. He's about 6'2". We call him a Punch and Judy hitter, but he was big enough. Sometimes he made good contact. So you had to play him decently, but we played him round to the left. So when Gil walked out of the dugout, I thought he was coming to take the pitch out. Because, like I said, we were getting our tails kicked. And he passed the pitcher's mound. So I thought, he going to see Buddy. So when he got to Buddy, he passed Buddy. I said, something happened behind me. I look around. I said, what the hell? So he walks up to me. I met him. He walked in. He said, you all right? Yeah, I'm fine, Gil. He said, do you think you could have held him to a single? I said, no way. I said, no. I said, Gil, look down. He looked down. His feet on the water. Mine's on the water. and Shea held, held water. So
trouble.
So he said, that's right. He said, you know what? He said, you got the bad ankle. He said, I just wondered why, you know. He said, normally you would have got over there and you would have held him to a single. I said, no way, Gil. I said, that's a double in anybody's ballpark. Right. He said, but you know, you got the bad ankle. So
that's when he took you out.
What he said, do you think you ought to come on? I said, yeah, that's fine. Right. I said, okay. We walked off the field, and then in the paper the next day, they say I tore the clubhouse up. I kicked over all the lockers and wall of coolers, and I never happened. I went inside, and trainer Joe Deere came in and started working on my ankle, iced it down and whatnot. And then the next day in the paper, oh man, Jones did this. So somebody said, did you read the paper? I said, what's it about? He said, it's about you. I said, hell, I know what I'm doing. I don't read about me.
Probably something more players in this day right, should pay attention to, right?
Yeah. So, but Gil, greatest manager I played for. Like I said, he'd have been a Hall of Fame manager. I think he should be in the Hall of Fame. And there was no animosity between us. He respected me as a player. But what he did was ingenious, really, because he woke everybody up. So everybody said, damn, if he goes out there and get Jones, he leading the league. You know what he'll do for us. So man, the team, they just got fired. They woke up. And on the field, working hard, doing all the right things, and it turned us around. And from that day forward, we were a good team. Mm-hmm. And that was because he could have sat there and let us get our tails kicked and not say or do anything. And we would have never gotten the message. Mm-hmm. But he sent a message. And I don't know whether it was intentional or what, but he sent a message, and everybody got the message. Mm-hmm. And we all know what happened after that. Yeah. we became a good team.
How'd you guys come together so much at the end? The great 49-game stretch to win the division by in a landslide, as it turned out, scoring 27 runs against the Braves in the NLCS in three games, and then beating up the Orioles the way you did. What sparked that whole run?
Well, when you know for a fact that you got four guys or five guys in your rotation that's going to go out and give up three runs or less, that's giving you a chance to win ball game. And that's what we had. We had five guys that's going to keep you in a ball game. And we knew that we had with the Braves. Let's look at the Braves. Braves didn't have anyone that you didn't want to face on that pitching staff. Phil, and if he had
Phil
a good,
Negro was their ace. Yeah.
If he had a good knuckleball, it still wasn't the greatest knuckleball. You know, he's gonna throw balls and have to come to you with a fastball, and you just have to be ready for it. So we knew that if we manufactured any runs. So there was no pressure for us to manufacture runs. Our thing was to play great defense and give our pitchers a chance to keep us in a ball game. And as a result, we did all the little things. You know, we bunted when you were supposed to bunt. We hit and run. We did all the little things. And everything worked in our favor. So, again, when I watch baseball today and I don't see any small ball at all. Mm-hmm. And that's both American League and the National League. I think about how Gil Hodges ran his ball club. It didn't matter. I was hitting 340. If A.G. got on and somebody else got on, I was bunting mm-hmm. to move those runners over. Mm-hmm. Maybe not in the first inning. But after that, I'm bunting. And then if Crane Pool, same shit we'd have, he's bunting. He's a fourth hitter, Clendenner. He plays small ball. And when you play small ball, you put pressure on the other team because they got to handle the ball. And that's when mistakes are made. When you got to make perfect throws, when there's a good bunt, when you have to cover the right bases, and do all those things, people make mistakes. And that allows you to manufacture runs. So we did all, you know, I tell everybody this. When in 69, it was late in 69 before Gil Hodges would let me hit 3-0. If I got three balls, anybody got three balls, no strike, you were taking one. And I went to him and I said, Gil, let me hit 3-0 once in a while. and he laughed. He laughed and said, I will. He said, I see you can handle it now. He said, and I will. But that's the kind of manager he was. And you soon learned that he was in charge. And I mean in charge. And everybody knew that, respect that, and they move forward with that.
Cleon, I want to do one more on 69, unless do you have any more?
Yeah,
okay,
no,
so one more on 69, and we want to get to just some of your great work, too, with your hometown in Mobile, Alabama mm-hmm. right now. But I want to go back to where we kind of started with you and that final catch. In that moment, do you remember precisely what you're thinking when that ball gets hit to you and you realize in that split second what you're about to do? And then also right after that, I know that you didn't have exactly a clear path to get back to the clubhouse because the fans rushed the field the way they did.
No path. When it's the ninth inning and it's two outs and David Johnson is at the bat, every good player wants the ball. You want the ball hit to you. You're saying, hit it to me. You want it. And at that moment, I was saying, we want to get out, but hit it my way. I know I can make the play. If you hit it anywhere in the ballpark, I can make the play because normally you play a little bit deeper. in that situation, so no ball can hit inside the fence without you catching it for a double. You play a little deeper. So I'm a little deeper. And when Kuzma made the pitch, I took one step back and I realized the ball was in front of me. And when I camped on the ball, all I'm saying, it took like 2 years for the ball to come down. I'm saying, come on down, baby, come on down. Come on down, baby, come on. Like it was never going to end. And I caught the ball and I kneeled and said, thank God. When I looked to the right field bullpen, Swoboda and AG gone. So evidently they left before I caught the ball. I said, damn, they had a lot of confidence in me, you know. So I'm running towards right field now, and I see the gates closed. Here come the crowd, they coming on the field. I turn around, go back to left field because it's the shortest distance. I had to jump over the fence to come down the hallway to get to the clubhouse. But that was great because about a half hour later, Rod Gaspar came into the clubhouse, no hat, no shoes, no gloves. They had torn his uniform off, torn all of his clothes off.
Oh my gosh.
And he had just his underwear and whatnot on, where the fans had ripped everything off. I don't know how he got, I guess he was in awe of what was happening. So he wanted to see everything take place. That's the wrong thing to do with that mob. So I asked the guys, I said, what happened? You knew I was supposed to. Oh man, we forgot with AG and Swoboda, and they're in the clubhouse when I get there. But it's a great season. But it wasn't just a great season for the Met organization. It's a great season for New Yorkers. Mm-hmm. The Jets winning.
Yeah.
The Knicks winning.
All against Baltimore teams too, right?
That's right. But not only that, you know, you got. Vietnam going on, walking on the moon, moon on the land, all of that's going on, and people are talking about, and a lot of folks worried about all of that, and here we come, winning the world championship, and you see little kids in the parking lots and little ball field, hollering, I'm Tommy Agee, I'm Cleon Jones, I'm Tom Seaver. Before that day, you couldn't hear that. Yeah. They was talking about Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio, and we had kind of flipped the script. They were talking about Met players. Yeah.
Amazing.
I'm sure a lot of people don't know the history, the rich history of baseball in Mobile, Alabama. You and AG are from there, but Amos Otis is from there. Hank Aaron, Willie McCovey, Billy Williams, Satchel Paige. We can go on and on with the people that are from Mobile and that path to the big leagues for you. You're doing a lot of work now in your hometown, in your home area, to try to rebuild a section in Mobile called Africa Town and to just enrich that tradition in that neighborhood again. What has put this in your heart to work with your wife every day and try to rebuild this area?
Well, we come from Africa Town. At least I do. My wife comes from Whistler, which is 3 miles away. Billy Williams, my wife, her cousins, they come from the same little home, but we all went to the same high school. And as I said before, it's an underserved area. And what we've always thought that we could go back home and make a difference. And since for 30 years now, it all seemed as if this just started last year or year before. But if you know the saga of Africa Town, which is where the last slave ship docked and the people, the cargo stayed, was in the Africa Town. The Amistad, with that group, they went back to their native country. Mm-hmm. But all of these people stayed in this little area called Africa Town and made a home. And that's where I grew up. That's where my mother, my grandmother, great-grandmother grew up. So it's an aging community wherein there probably hadn't been a house built there in 30 years. And most of the dwellings were built in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s that need refurbishing in some way. The school there is one of the oldest schools in the state. Needs a lot of help at the school and the churches. So in order to maintain the history of the school, the community, and the churches, you have to somehow entice people to move back into the community. And the only way you can do that is you build and entice younger folk. The average age in my community now is probably 60 years of age. And so if we don't do something, right now, I'll tell you what we got going. We have a community garden, which is about 8 to 10 acres that we do for the community. We do a farmer's market for health food and health and wellness and make sure everybody can eat right. And we do things with the homeless, with the elderly, because there's a lot of elderly people in the area. And when you try to tackle all of this each and every day, that's what we do every day. We help people that they've been burned out of their homes. We go in and help rebuild the homes, put them back in the home. People who have property that's been passed down from one generation to the next, can't afford to keep the property clean, to pay the taxes. We try to assist in all those things, help keep the property clean. In other words, what we're trying to do is make sure that there's an Africa Town tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for us to preserve the history and the welfare of the community. And the only way we can do that is make sure that people get what they need in the community, whether it be home, health care, or what have you, that we find a way that they can get what they need. And so that's what we do each and every day. But my project now is to build 3 houses. Wow. In the community. And that's what I'm working to do now. So if I can build 3 houses and I can get some offspring of the community to move back to the community to help revitalize and fertilize and grow the community, then we're working to some point in time that we're going to have a viable community and perpetuate growth. We don't have to worry about our churches being depleted, our school being depleted or outdated, because numbers matter. Mm-hmm. When I grew up in the community, it was over 12,000 people in there. Mm-hmm. Now it's only 1,900. Mm-hmm. In the community. So I'm working to try to get it back to at least half of that. And that's what we do every day.
It's amazing work that you're doing to know, keep that community going. And I mean, this was so incredible.
We could
do hours and hours and hours with you, but wonderful to relive those memories. Thank you so much. And you know, we look forward to seeing you at Citi Field for the big celebration.
Oh man,
this
look forward to being
well.
There. Thank you guys, man.
Thank you, Cleon.
We need to do this more often, man.
Anytime.
Anytime.
Yeah, okay.
All right. We'll bring Jay Horowitz next time.
Yeah, bring Jay. Yeah. But I tell everybody, man, we were family long before Pirates became family.
Yeah.
This group, and I'm saying on the field and off the field, and we all keep in touch. And I tell everybody, the only person I'm hesitant about calling is Ron Svoboda. You call him, and he does all the talking. And I have to remind him, I said, Ron, I called you. I have something to say. But he goes on and on. And we talk quite a bit.
Well, you know,
but we were a close-knit group. Even the wives were close-knit. And that's because we love one another. And that wasn't a time that if I came up in the ninth inning and Seaver needed a run to win a ball game, and if I couldn't deliver that run, man, it hurt me to no end. So that's how much we cared about one another, so it was a good group. I thought we would win three or four championships with that group. But all the cards have to fall in place.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the injuries and all the other things, it probably would have happened.
And the one that you did win was legendary.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
That number
legendary.
One.
That number one, the first one.
Number
Thank
one.
You so much, Clem.
All right, man.
Wonderful.
All right, guys. All right.
The great Cleon Jones, many thanks to him for knocking that out with us.
It was
excited.
Great.
He seemed excited.
He loves it.
But yeah.
We made the trip from Mobile, Alabama.
When we heard he was going to be in spring training, we said, we got to get Cleon. And we thought maybe he'd be hesitant. Nobody knows about this podcast outside of our little neck of the woods.
Yeah.
And?
No doubt about that.
And?
He was great.
He was into it.
He was into it.
He was into it.
Might have been his first podcast interview ever.
I mean, I'm sure it was. Right?
And you know what? He knocked it out of the park.
Favorite part?
My favorite part was just reliving the final out that he had to, you know, escape from the ballpark because everybody was crowding the field. There was no way to get from left field back to the home dugout, so we had to jump over the fence and go around the back.
Can you imagine that nowadays? I agree wholeheartedly. That's all I kept thinking when he's telling that story. And you've seen the footage 1,000 times, not just with the 1969 Mets, but that happened all over the place for decades. Can you imagine now? Can you imagine in 2015 when the Mets clinched the division, everybody pouring onto the field in Cincinnati?
You know, even I think when the Mets won the division in 86, they did it. But then after that, they had the horseback police out there, and they wouldn't let anyone on the field for the World Series clincher. But
well, now you get every game, anytime there's, I don't know if you can see it from your vantage point, but where I sit, every time there is a stoppage where either a manager
like
cuts
50 guards,
all the guards, they just fly onto the field to make sure nobody hops on.
It's just a different world. Whether that's good or bad, it's just different.
Different world. Great stuff from Cleon. We are so looking forward. If you're listening to this episode as soon as it comes out, we are so looking forward to the weekend upcoming. If you're listening to it well after the weekend, then I'm sure it was a wonderful, wonderful affair.
Yes, I'm sure it was, and I'm sure that everyone that was a part of it enjoyed it, including the master of ceremonies, Howie Rose, who I think has circled this day on his calendar for about 50 years.
Well, we've circled this day, the release of this podcast, for a while. Been so excited to share it with you. Hopefully you enjoyed it.
Yeah, rate it. Review it.
Rate it, review it. Subscribe.
Yes.
Subscribe. In this day and age, we need subscriptions.
That's right. Subscribers. We don't need the subscriptions. We need them to be.
I mean, it's all one and the same.
Subscribers.
Wayne.
I understand.
It's all one and the same.
Okay.
He's Wayne Randazzo.
Good night,
everybody. Steve Gelps. Good night. Good afternoon. Have yourself a great, wherever you are, whatever you're doing right now.